Welcome to Creative Conversations. I'm Roger Humphrey. In this episode, I'm pleased to welcome the award-winning composer, Edward Smaldell. Please join us as we discuss the latest CD that features his music, What No One Else Sees. I've listened to it. It's beautiful. We also talk about his approach to writing and teaching, even slip in a little guitar there. We talk about a lot of other stuff too. Before we begin, please hit the like and subscribe buttons. It's free and it's easy, and it really helps the channel a lot. Thanks. And we are welcoming to the show Dr. Edward Smaldell. Thank you for coming on the show. I so deeply appreciate this.
I'm glad to be here. Very glad to be here.
So I have had the opportunity, and I want to say it was a pleasure to listen to some of your music, including the music on your new CD, What No One Else Sees. A quick observation, I have to, I guess if I had to make a public confession, many times I get a chance to listen to music, but I don't have a big chance, so I kind of have to go through and sample.
Right.
And I was disappointed because I didn't want to sample. I wanted to listen to the whole darn thing.
Oh, that's very nice. That's very
it's,
nice.
It's a modern language. Mm-hmm. And I know people who are used to Taylor Swift might be a little uncomfortable, but it's the world we live in. But
that's right.
But having said that, I've heard a lot of music in modern language that, quite frankly, doesn't appeal to me. I mean, I can appreciate it artistically a little bit, but I don't find much entertainment value. Yours, I just found very compelling. I just wanted to listen to it.
Well, that warms my heart. One of the things that I've said for a long time, and unfortunately, the two people I'm going to refer to, neither of them are with us anymore. But I was a student of George Perles, among a number of other people. Uh-huh. And George Perle, for those who might not know, was a very brainy composer and a very brainy individual, and he wrote very brainy music. But he was a music theorist and a composer, and he wrote very challenging, extraordinary music. And he was a very tough critic. My mother-in-law was a lover of music. She had no formal music education. Even though her daughter, my wife of 45 years, is a pianist. But she was a lover of music, one of those people of a generation that, would had WQXR on the radio constantly, and just listened and would sing along because she had been listening her whole life. So she knew all the great literature, didn't know what anything was called, wouldn't know Sonata Allegro form from a manhole cover, but loved music. And what I've said many times is that I wanted to write music that would appeal to both of those people, because I've spent 35 years as a music theory teacher, teaching theory composition, ear training, music appreciation, all kinds of things. But getting under the hood and discussing musical details, musical theoretical details, whether it's Beethoven or Schoenberg. But at the same time, this is something I learned from Leslie Bassett, who was a wonderful composer, who described, Mr. and Mrs. John Q. Public, who bothered to get up out of their couch, get in the car, drive to the symphony hall, get in a chair, pay for a ticket. They probably went out to eat and spent money they didn't have. And now they're going to sit here and you're going to play something for them. And you've got kind of an obligation to give them something that they can get. They don't have to get everything. But right. there should be something on the surface that's appealing in a very visceral way, I like to try to address both of those things. I find a lot of contemporary composition is either painfully simple or painfully complex. I live in a middle ground between those two. some people, you know, the people that love the simple stuff think my music is too complex, and the people that love the complex stuff sometimes think my music is too straightforward. I can't worry about them. you know, I got to please me. That way I'm sure of pleasing somebody. Right. And that's what I'm trying to do.
I know that in an interview many, many, many years ago on 60 Minutes, Vladimir Horowitz addressed that because he had taken some heat from the critics about playing some of the basic repertoire, some of the Chopin and, you know, eight, you know, and some of the pieces and
chestnuts.
And he was asked why he included those in his programs, you know, instead of some more adventuresome stuff.
Right.
And he had a very, very interesting take on it. He said, many, 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 many people in that audience are not there because they want to be there. They're there because somebody brought them. But he said their money and their time is just as important. It's just as valuable. And he said, I owe them something that they can take home with them at the end of the evening.
Yeah, I agree with that. You know, another of my heroes is Heinrich Schenker, who lately is getting something of a bad rap. I don't know if you are aware of the controversy around Schenker lately.
There's been some
discussion, especially among music theorists, that Schenker's approach, his whole approach, and sort of he was a, you know, he was an anti-Semite and a racist. And his entire theory is racist and white supremacist, and I think that whole argument goes quite a bit farther than it needs to go. I mean, the fact is that music theory for a long time, and just about everything that Schenker ever analyzed, was focused on the music of dead white male composers. Truth. And there's been a lot of effort in recent years to try to address some of that. There are a few composers from the Baroque and the Classical and the Romantic era that are BIPOC composers and so forth that have gotten more attention, which is a good thing. There are composers from the composers of today are quite a bit more diverse than they've ever been, and that's a good thing. I think it's kind of astounding that the minute that people turned around and said, you know what, we haven't been paying attention to African-American composers. Let's go find some. Guess what? They're out there. It's not like, you know, they've been, you know, hiding in plain sight for a long time. So now they're getting more attention. I think that's a good thing. You know, I apologize for holding up Schenker as a hero. But he had a lot to do with my thinking in terms of tonal music. The analysis of tonal music, which is to say the analysis of music, and that is there's an arc, there's a line that the music is not simply a series of pretty moments any more than a Shakespeare play is a series of great lines. Of course they're great lines, but those lines add up to a dramatic arc that pulls us along. And I think that's something that a lot of contemporary music misses. There might be really interesting things at a moment, but I don't feel like it's pulling me somewhere. I don't think it's telling a story.
I think a lot of it, storyline is missing. I think we're drawn to stories, whether we understand the language or not.
That's right.
I know I remember reading a very highly regarded and best-selling book by an author 15, 20 years ago. And I bought the book based on the review, and the review had included some of the lines and some of the you know, things from a couple of paragraphs. Uh-huh. And I was just absolutely taken with the beauty of the language and just how well this author was able to craft a sentence and put together.
Yeah.
But I bought the book and I was terribly disappointed because the story was dreadful. It was just like,
yeah, well, see, right. You kind
just
of need
like
both of them, right.
all of this great technique and all of this great knowledge, all this great
Right.
talent, you know, telling a just a story that really wasn't worth listening to.
That's right. Yeah. And I mean, one of the things that I'm a fan of comedy. I've kind of regarded my 35-year as a 35-year career as a classroom teacher as kind of a long stint of stand-up. Because when I'm teaching a theory class, I'm trying to make jokes and I'm trying to keep the, if the students are paying attention just so that they don't miss a punchline, now they're paying attention.
Right.
The storyline in an actual composition to me is something that's quite abstract.
Oh, yeah.
All of my compositions, most of them anyway, have these descriptive titles, and I've made an effort to try to describe in words the kind of journey that the audience might be going on if as they listen to the piece. But the fact is that in almost every case, the title came to me when the piece was at least half done, because I work in a purely abstract way. To me, the story is a purely abstract story. You listen to a Tchaikovsky symphony, not the Romeo and Juliet fantasy overture, but a symphony. There's a story. There's a story that's every bit as compelling as Romeo and Juliet. In fact, if you didn't know the story of Romeo and Juliet and you simply listened to that overture, you would get a very compelling story that would be in your imagination in a totally abstract way. That's the kind of music that I want to write.
So
Music that
you don't start out with an idea of I'm going to
never,
write about bugs on a leaf or
never,
something like that.
never. I sit down at the piano and I bang away at a few things. Sometimes I record it, sometimes I don't. Sometimes I just do something, go, ooh, I like that. And then I write it down. And then I keep going and I've got books filled with these things. And I write it on a piece of paper, on a piece of music paper. And then once it's on a piece of music paper, I have to decide, okay, is that a B flat or an A sharp? Is it this or is it that? How am I going to spell this? Is it this register or is it that register? What's the dynamic? What's the articulation? Which instruments might this be? If I'm writing for a, it doesn't matter what I'm writing for. It starts with something on the piano that's purely abstract. And then once I have something, once I have that nugget of gold, that seed that's going to give me something to work with, and it's always got to be something that hangs in your ear. It's got to be something, Michelangelo, I think it was, talked about, a good sculpture is one you can roll down a hill. It's gonna it's gonna it's not just gonna fall apart. It's not fragile. It's something you can recognize from a distance. If I've got a when I find a nugget like that, then I start to manipulate it and turn it around and play with it and see what kind of counterpoint, what kind of development it would lead to, what kinds of passages might then be a foil against it. If it's something lively, maybe this follows by something more lyrical. If it's lyrical, it's followed by something live. I mean, the music appreciation, mantra is that music is formed by repetition and contrast. If you don't have both of those things, actually, you can have one or the other of those things, you're talking about 30 or 40% of the current musical field right now.
I went to I'm a guitar guy, and I went to yeah, I saw that back there. We'll talk. Mine's
Yes.
over
Well,
here.
that yes. Yeah, I did a little bit of that. I've mostly my guitar is mostly that.
I went to a famous guitarist, and he was premiering a new piece in that particular concert. First half of the concert was standard repertoire, and everybody was just, during intermission was ooh and ah and how wonderful and so on. And he got into the second half, and he was doing this new piece, and it's very long. It was about 20 minutes long. No movement. Well, no discernible movements. It just seemed.
Right. And one thing after another for 20 minutes.
And you had the sense that he started in the middle of the thing and was going to end in the middle of it. I mean, just never really felt like it had a beginning or an ending or any real mm-hmm. arc to it. And these same people who were singing his praises a half an hour, 30 minutes later, were literally getting up and walking out of the theater going, that's it, I'm done. And well, so it's sad. I don't blame him, I guess, other than he was the one that programmed it. But
right. But, I mean, he might have chosen a better piece. You know, I mean, getting back to the whole story arc, you know, I think that some of the most exciting stories are told in the symphonies of the classical and romantic era, the string quartets, the piano sonatas. These are totally abstract works. Titles like, you know, The Moonlight or The Pathétique notwithstanding.
Right.
And those, of course, were all added later. Beethoven didn't just sit down and stare out the window going, oh, I'm going to write about the moonlight and sit down and write that piece. Somebody thought about it later. That's kind of what I do. And that doesn't mean that the music doesn't have a story if right. you don't know it. It just means that, if anything, the titles are a little bit of a concession to the audience. Okay, if you'd like to have a little something to think about, you could think about this, but you don't have to. And it only gives them a very general sort of framework to think about. And then hopefully they're listening and they go, oh, that's an interesting melody. Oh, look, it's imitated there. Oh, look, there's a cadence. Oh, look, there's a contrast. Oh, look. And it somehow adds up to something that, you know, has a beginning, middle, and end.
So I totally agree with that. I think that we are all drawn to stories. Whether I know you write for dance, for example, and I know mm-hmm. dance, some of the best ones seem to have some sort of a storyline to them. Okay, I mean some of it's a little schmaltzy, you know, but some of it's absolutely lovely, and you have a sense, even if you don't understand, again, if you don't understand the language, you still have a sense that somebody is trying to explain something to you or tell you something,
right.
and you kind of want to lean into it a little bit, and I like that a lot.
Well, I've watched dancers work, they don't say, okay, so this is the gesture that means this, and this is the gesture. No, they stand in front of a mirror and they make stuff up and they'll say, oh, I like that. Let's keep that and let's add this to it. And then from that, I can go over here and then I can do this. And they're piecing together movements that are going to, you know, accumulate into, some kind of a story.
Right.
Colonies, the McDowell Colony in Yaddo and places like that, and have spoken also to visual artists, especially visual artists that lean towards abstract expressionism and that kind of thing, non-representational art. They start with a gesture and an idea, and they're kind of improvising until it starts to take shape. One of my heroes there is Willem de Kooning, who yeah. I've read about. That's the way he would work. Even when he was, even when he had a model, he was, you know, and my, one of my favorite things about, that I've read about him is that, you know, he'd be, you know, 3/4 of the way through this thing. And he'd go, no, it needs to be 6 inches over here. And he'd start again because, you know, it doesn't mean there's no structure because it's abstract. It just means that the abstractions are the structure and they are the story.
So let's talk about guitar for a second, if we can, yeah. because that's, I started off as a kid playing, strumming guitar and singing folk songs, mm-hmm. And I'm struck by the passing of Peter Yarrow recently.
Yes, yes.
From Peter, Paul, and Mary, of course, mm-hmm. and I was so inspired by him as a young boy. Wow. He's about 10 years older than I, and mm-hmm. So they were just getting started, just as I was learning how to play an F chord.
Wow!
And so that was really something that for me to lean into. So as I later on transitioned from strumming and singing into instrumental music and being a classical guitarist, I've still got an ear for that melodic line.
Yeah, well, so, you know, I mean, I started pretty much the same way. I started strumming a guitar, and then, you know, got an electric guitar. And you know, my early musical training was totally intuitive. I mean, my ear training when I was, you know, 12 or 13 years old was listening to Jimi Hendrix and trying to figure out how to play some of that stuff.
Sure.
You know, I was in band in high school. I couldn't read music, but I was in several bands. Most of the time we'd listen to something and I would learn how to do it and then teach everyone else. Then I got into a band that had a guy who wrote everything out. We were doing Chicago and Blood, Sweat and Tears and Tower of Power,
wow.
People like this. And he handed me a piece of music. I said, "What's that?" you know, so, you know, in high school, I kind of got interested in music in a way that I wanted to study more seriously. So I started to take piano lessons. And that's kind of, so I was like a senior in high school when I learned how to read music. And then immediately went to Queens College and became a music major, you know, a year later. And, you know, it's all worked out. And I did learn how to read music. But the kind of the intuitive process of music was always something that was very important to me, and that's where this kind of combination of jazz and improvisation, and the spirit of improvisation, informs my music. I'm not a fan of free jazz, for example. Improvisation has to have a structure. It doesn't just fly, and what I've learned from many years as an improviser, as well as working with other improvisers, is I have a theory that every improviser has a kind of a bag of tricks. There are these things that they know how to do, that they understand how to do, whether it's licks or scales or ideas. Or theoretical combinations. When you're in this key, you can do this. And when you're in that key, you can do that. Whatever it is, they've got a bag of tricks. The really good ones have a really big bag so that they can disguise the fact that it's a bag of tricks. And they can actually make connections on the spot and spontaneously that maybe they never realized, but they're still pulling from things. You know, a great chef can't go into a kitchen and make anything that tastes good if he doesn't know what every single one of those things tastes like.
Right.
You just can't do it.
Right.
So, I think they've got a cooking show. I'm a fan of cooking also. They've got a cooking show now that showed something. You're not allowed, the competition was you're not allowed to taste while you're cooking. Can you imagine?
Ugh.
How could you know if that
was
enough?
You got to know your stuff.
Well, you know, you got to know. I mean, a good chef can look at a bunch of ingredients and say, a little of this, a little of that. Ooh, and you know what? I never put these two things together, but I know what they're going to taste like because I know what they taste like separately. And right. I'm going to do this and texture and this and that. That's what an improviser does. That's what a composer does. I just choose not to do it spontaneously and rely on, you know, whether I've got a good rhythm section, but I put it all down on paper. And then I'm hoping that when it's performed, it kind of sounds like it's, you know, sort of springing from the universe right at that moment.
Do you use any of the modern tools where you can, like, you know, do electronics and get a sense of what it's going to sound like?
Yes. I mean, I've been using Finale, which is a
yep.
music notation software,
right? Yeah.
For since 1987,
okay.
And it's now I may have to either retire from composing or learn a new program because they're sort of
they've just killed it. They shot it.
They just killed it. So that might clear the field. There'll be a lot of people that'll say, you know what, I'm going to the beach. That's it.
Yeah, I actually switched from Finale. One of the Finale I found to be very difficult for guitar to try to put in fingerings.
Everything is very difficult for guitar. That's another thing.
Except I use MuseScore now, and I have for a couple of
Oh,
years,
okay.
and the fingerings are very easy.
Oh, okay.
And so there's a little bit, and it's free. I like free a lot.
Well,
And
yeah.
the
Well,
people who wrote the code for that, I think, are some of the same people who wrote the code for Finale. So you start
I
seeing a
mean,
lot of familiar things in there.
yeah. Yeah, the new one, I'm drawing a blank on the name
Yeah,
of
me
the,
too. I remember. I know what you're talking about.
but there's a new one that is, has gotten some very good reviews and has already been developed quite a bit, and is also developed by the guys by guys that were very active with both Finale and Sibelius. So
Okay.
that they're trying to learn their lessons. Part of the problem is that concert music and orchestral music is not where they make their money. That's th there aren't you know th there are a lot more composers that are writing lead sheets or doing Broadway or
Commercials, things like that.
commercials, educational things, which are all fine, but the specific, if we want to get into the weeds, the specific details of how to create a score and that and how to create a set of parts from that score, to I have tremendous respect for the engravers of the 19th century and the 20th century, for that matter. What copyists were able to do, and the fact that we have warehouses filled with Universal and Eulenberg and Peters and all of the Abyssinian Hawks, all of these engraved editions of the masterworks of the 19th and 20th century.
Right.
It's amazing.
It is indeed. So you've written a couple of pieces for classical guitar. I had a chance
Yes.
to listen to one of the pieces, the Prelude, I believe.
Yeah, it's really one piece, two movements.
Okay. So
Yeah.
I listened to the first movement
Oh, wow.
and wasn't able to listen to the second one. I like it a lot. I don't perform anymore, and
Okay.
age-related health issues and so,
Yeah, oh.
I still play and I still teach a little bit. I still dabble. You okay?
Yeah, my it's maybe it's the ghosts of Zoom, but a shelf that's got probably too many CDs on it just moved. So as soon as we get off this call, if there's a huge crash, that's what it was. Yikes.
Yikes.
But anyway, I'd be happy to share a score with you.
Thank you. I appreciate the offer, but unfortunately, I think it would just go over there in the cabinet and I'd never really get to play it. But I thank you for that. I have actually a former student of mine and close friend who reviews new scores for Guitar Foundation of America. So
Oh,
he may have it already. I don't know if your publisher has sent it to him or not, but
I don't
it,
know. That's actually not with my publisher right now.
oh,
So I'll work on that. It's
okay.
it's something that I wrote a long time ago, and I still like the piece, but it's very challenging. It's the Prelude is not that difficult to play. It the dance, which I really like, is actually quite challenging to play. The spacings, if I can make a confession, I wrote the piece checking things out on an electric guitar. So the spacings, some things that are not that, and I've got a pretty big spread. So a pretty big spread on an electric guitar doesn't translate into the same spread on a
I
classical.
actually bought a new guitar a few years ago because I can't do that anymore. The span of my hand, and so I it, it's a it's a it's a shorter scale. Now I can play the pieces that I had fallen out of my repertoire because I just couldn't do it. I mean, even using bad words, I couldn't make it happen.
Capo. That's another, I put a capo on the second fret and now all the frets are a little closer together.
I've done that. I do that a lot with Renaissance music anyway,
Yeah.
because it thins the tone out a little bit and gets a little closer to that
Yes.
lute sonority.
Yeah. Yep,
So,
yep. Interesting.
Now, are you still teaching?
Well, I think I did. I don't know if I said that, but I've referred to how long my career is because it's kind of finished. I retired back in September after 35 years at Queen's College. You know, there are quite a few of my colleagues who have, you know, stayed the course quite a bit longer. I mean, I could have, you know, kept teaching. I still enjoy the classroom, but I just decided that, you know, I have a family, I've got grandchildren, I've got a lot of music I want to write. And, you know, I think the world has heard my discussion of the diminished seventh chord enough times. I don't really need to go back and teach another dozen or two students about the, you know, the common tone diminished seventh chord.
That's funny.
Basta. You know, I'm getting tired of hearing myself give these explanations, you know.
I hear that. You know, I taught a lot of beginning guitar lessons for a lot of years.
Yeah.
And I mean, I started giving guitar lessons for money when I was 19. So so you know, I have talked about how to tune a guitar and how to play a C chord and how to make a bar chord over and over again, you know, ad nauseum.
You know, somebody once, you know, among the things that I enjoyed teaching when we were teaching in person, especially, was music appreciation. And you know, you there's something exciting about leading someone in their first experience with something. You know, you only get to hear Beethoven's Fifth Symphony for the first time once. And to watch that happen, especially if it's a group of engaged students, is very nice. That can translate to the first time they understand, you know, what a secondary dominant is when they finally get that. That's, you know, that's the joy of teaching, you know, the sort of less advanced topics. But, you know, I think it's got a sell by date that I think has just
there's
passed.
A shelf life.
Yep.
So now with your newest CD, I don't want to stop before I talk to you a little bit about this.
Yeah.
What No One Else Sees is the name of the CD, and this is all your music.
Yes.
Now, did you have any input on this? Did you?
I was the primary architect of the whole thing.
Okay.
So two of the pieces are orchestral pieces that were recorded in. One of them is as far away as 2013, they were recorded in Glasgow and in Brno, they were released on the Ablaze record label in compilations with a group of other composers. Then I had these two concerti, the clarinet concerto and the piano concerto, that are much more recent pieces, and I wanted to release those. And I decided that rather than releasing a couple of big orchestral pieces with a bunch of chamber, I've got a lot of other chamber pieces I could have filled out the disc with, but I decided that you know, bringing all of these orchestral pieces together would be a nice thing to do. You know, to have an orchestral CD is kind of a big deal. So they all came together. The first recording is back in 2013, and the most recent recording was May of 2024. And then along the way, you know, performers have to. I don't know if I want to get this out in the public, but. You know, if I start having a conversation with a performer and I say to them, you know, I should write you a piece, if they are foolish enough to say, that's a nice idea, there'll be something in their mailbox before they know it. You know, the clarinet soloist had foolishly said, have you got anything for woodwind quintet? And I said, no, but I'll write one. He said, okay. There you go. So I wrote one. It also turns out that all these performers, all the both the orchestras and the soloists and the woodwind quintet are all European performers. It's all American music performed by European forces, which is kind of interesting. I don't know what that means in particular, but that's just what it is. It wasn't planned that way. It just kind of worked out.
So, well, believe it or not, sir, we are out of time.
That well,
just
thank
by
you.
So quickly. So I'm going to say goodbye and give you time to go fix your shelf.
There you go. It hasn't collapsed. Thank you very much.
I
appreciate
soon,
the time.
I want to thank Edward Smaldone for taking the time to come on the show. And I want to thank you, too, for taking the time to listen. I really appreciate it. If you'd like to keep up with my guests, just go to www.rogerhumphrey.com and click on the blog tab at the top of the page. And if you like what you see, please go back to the homepage and hit subscribe. I promise, no spam. Thanks again. I hope you'll continue to listen to Creative Conversations with Roger Humphrey.